This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream. You're listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. On February 14th, women who have been affected by violence are invited to go out onto the street and dance as part of a global event organized by Eve Ensler, called 1 Billion Rising. She calls it a woman spring, playing off the Arab Spring, of course, and says, "We want to shake the globe literally and announce that it's time to end violence against women and girls." Celebrity Anne Hathaway has joined the cause, saying in an interview in Glamour magazine, "When I think back to some of the most fun nights of my life, it was just me out dancing without a care in the world. It's a release, an outlet, and I'm a firm believer that we can tap into a collective energy and consciousness. On the 14th, even if you're in a field dancing by yourself, you're going to know that you're not alone. That's something I hope we can carry forward as we resolve to protect ourselves and our sisters." So the idea of people coming together across the globe to fight violence against women sounds wonderful, and it's certainly something that's needed. But some questions remain in some feminists' minds about how productive such an event can be and whether dancing is a useful way to respond collectively to rape and other forms of violence against women. I spoke with author and radical feminist Lierre Keith about some of these issues and about building a culture of resistance from her home in California. Here's that interview. So on February 14th, women who have been affected by violence are invited to go out into the street and dance as part of this global event organized by Eve Ensler. And the slogan on the website says, 1 in 3 women on the planet will be raped or beaten in her lifetime. 1 billion women violated is an atrocity. 1 billion women dancing is a revolution. And on one hand, as you know, it's undeniable that misogyny and violence against women is a global epidemic and an atrocity. But, you know, when I watched the video for 1 Billion Rising, which begins with some quite disturbing images of rape and other forms of violence against women, and then about halfway through turns into women globally, you know, rising up and dancing, I couldn't help but watch it with some level of skepticism. And I wonder, what was your reaction to that video?
Yeah, I had a similar reaction, and I would actually encourage anybody who's listening to this discussion to actually hit pause right now and go to the 1 Billion Rising website and actually look at the film that we're talking about, because I think you have to see it to really understand why some of us find it problematic. So, like Megan, like you said, it starts with, you know, you watch all these terrible things. There's a woman who's being genitally mutilated. There's a man battering a woman and her child. There's a man raping a woman. There's a man sexually harassing a woman at work. There's women working in terrible conditions in a factory somewhere in Asia. So you see this whole scope of, you know, poverty, violence, sexual violence, you know, all the things that women are trying to survive under right now in patriarchy. And then about 2 minutes into this, suddenly women start meditating. And they meditate, and they meditate, and then the ground literally shakes. There's this wave that rocks through the earth, and then all of a sudden, all of these horrible perpetrators are immobilized, and the women can just walk away. And then they all start dancing. And I find this very problematic as a political plan. We don't have access to some magic meditative force that is somehow going to immobilize the perpetrators and dismantle this system called patriarchy. And I think it's extremely dangerous when political movements go in that direction. And there are examples throughout history of political movements doing exactly that, of embracing these kind of millennialist spiritual solutions to what are political and economic material conditions, and they end in disaster each and every time. I mean, that's 100%. There's never been an instance where, in fact, magic was able to stop, you know, horrible atrocities. So I just find it very disturbing that that's where, you know, this is the plan according to this 1 billion rising event, that we're somehow going to change this using our minds. That, you know, our minds are somehow powerful enough to immobilize some of the worst, you know, some of the most horrible, violent things that are happening on the planet right now. And I know a lot of women who are very excited about watching that film and who are really excited to be part of 1 Billion Rising, and I can't quite understand where, like, why it doesn't sort of, it derailed for me right there. Like, I think the first half of it is really, is very powerful. And I think one of the reasons women are so attracted to this event is because at least partly it tells the truth. And the truth is that, you know, there's a class of people called men and there's a class of people called women, and men have power over women, and that's called patriarchy, right? That's what male supremacy is it creates these two political classes and it gives, you know, one power over the other. And that power is held in place, by these atrocious acts of violence. And that's indeed what creates the class of people called women, is incest and rape and battering and poverty. So to the extent that 1 billion rising tells the truth about the fact that those are atrocities, I think that a lot of women, find that to be really compelling and inspiring. And, you know, thank God someone's telling the truth. When do we ever hear the truth about patriarchy in the mass media? You know, we look around and all we see are images of women for sale, you know, women on display, women as objects who deserve abuse, women defined as sexual orifices, on and on and on. I mean, we know what's going on around us, and yet no one will stand up, you know, publicly and say, you know, this is all part of rape culture, it's all part of the continuum. So we never hear the truth about the fact that we are living in a terrorist state. You know, if you're female, that's the backdrop of your life, is this terror about rape and incest and battering. So to the extent that 1 billion rising actually names some of that, I think that's why women are so attracted to it. The problem is that the event, you know, the creators of the event have only gone halfway. So they're willing to say these terrible things are happening, but that's exactly the problem. It's all in the passive voice. They never once on this website name men as a class. Mm-hmm. It's all this, like, you know, 1 in 3 women will be raped or beaten. And it's like it's a fire or a flood or a flu epidemic. You know, it just sort of falls out of the sky. It's an act of God. You know, a bad thing is happening. And it's not just a random bad thing. You know, it's a political system created by human beings, and it can be dismantled by human beings. But we're going to have to name who's in charge, what the material institutions are, how those institutions are created, and then figure out ways to dismantle them. And we're not going to get there if we don't actually name the truth about who's doing what to whom. And that's what feminism does. It's not just bad things because people are sinful, or bad things because God hates you, or bad things because that's how nature invented us. You know, evolution is somehow responsible. No, feminism says this is a political system, and it's called patriarchy, it's called male supremacy. And we have the power as human beings to change it and, you know, to create a just system rather than an unjust system. So the first problem is this passive voice, where she never names men on the entire website. You know, it's just a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And then second problem I have right away, what's the first sentence on the website? I'm looking at the website right now. The second sentence, 1 billion women violated is an atrocity. Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And it's amazing that somebody can at least say that out loud, that it's that many of us have had to survive this, that all of us are living under the shadow of this, you know, these horrible acts. Well, then the third sentence, 1 billion women dancing is a revolution. I just draw it kind of short right there because, I mean, we could go through a list of other historical atrocities, some of them still ongoing, and nobody ever suggests that the people, you know, who are being oppressed in these ways should dance mm-hmm. as some kind of action to stop the atrocity. I mean, we'll just take one, you know, very current, Guantanamo Bay. Here you've got these men who have been there for, I don't know, 10, 12 years, the isolation shutouts, you know, the waterboarding, they're being tortured. It's like horrendous, right? nobody says, well, you know, put on your orange jumpsuits and put on some cute tunes and dance. It would just be so offensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of the problem is if you're not willing to name this as a political structure and a political system, then it has to derail because you can't come up with a political solution then. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, this does not offer us a political solution to a political problem. It offers us a very individual solution, which is essentially personal empowerment, I guess. I'm never quite sure what people mean when they say that, but that seems to be the underlying tone of this, is you'll dance, you'll achieve some interior state that's fun, that makes you somehow feel powerful. This is very different than actually having political power. And that's why I have always had such a hard time with that kind of empowerment language. It's like, I don't actually care what your interior state is. That's not the point of a resistance movement like feminism. The point is to actually change the material conditions so that we all have more liberty and more justice in our lives. And, I mean, yes, dancing, you know, does actually improve your mood. I understand exercise does that. It, you know, you do get a flood of endorphins will be released in your brain, and it makes people very happy to do these things. And it's great. Go out and do it. I think it's wonderful. I'm glad people can have fun sometimes, but that's not in any way a response to an actual atrocity. And so I just find it very insulting that, you know, we can name this as an atrocity, and yet, you know, it just derails into this rather bizarre kind of solution.
Mm-hmm. And again, on the website, it describes the event as a global strike, an invitation to dance, a call to men and women to refuse to participate in the status quo until rape and rape culture ends, an act of solidarity, demonstrating to women the commonality of their struggles and their power in numbers. So I guess it's implying that it's something about this collective resistance via this, we're all going to dance on the 14th. It goes on, a refusal to accept violence against women and girls as a given, a new time and a new way of being. So those are pretty, you know, inspiring statements. What do you think about those statements, those words?
Well, you know, it starts by saying 1 Million Rising is a global strike.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would that were true, if this in fact was a call for a billion women to go on strike, I would be ecstatic about this event. It's not. I mean, there's nothing actually in here about going on strike. Women do 2/3 of the world's work. We earn 10% of the world's wages, and we own less than 1% of the world's wealth. So you've got patriarchy and capitalism all cozied up in the biggest pyramid scheme that's ever been devised, and you've got rich white men on top, and poor women, mostly women of color, at the very bottom, and they're rich because we're poor. We could bring the system to a halt by noon using an incredible nonviolent technique like having a global strike. Because we're the ones, I mean, it's our labor that makes the whole thing keep going. So that's the power of a strike. When the workers strike, that's what happens. You know, work comes to a halt. And we could so easily bring this to a halt by using a technique like that. So it's very depressing to me to see that this on here, you know, that this is a global strike. When, in fact, she's not calling for a strike. Well, why not call for a strike? Why not? If you're going to organize a billion women, which is what the goal of this event is, let's organize them to go on strike and stop the global economy. Let's bring down capitalism and patriarchy. Why not? We could do it. The power is ultimately in our hands, which is why it works when you go on strike. You know, they can't keep going with it. If we refuse to be exploited, they can't exploit us. And if we stand up, you know, en masse as an entire class around the globe, it would be over. I mean, in a few days, we could have justice on this planet. There's no question. So why are we organizing for that? Why are we organizing women to dance? Mm-hmm. I mean, just to me, the juxtaposition is just, I mean, it's just sort of stunning. Like, this is as far as we can think as, well, we'll all try to feel a little bit better and have some fun, rather than, look, let's do some serious business here and get to work on making justice for women and children. So there's a disjuncture there as well. And then there's this statement about it's a call to men and women to refuse to participate in the status quo. And that's as close as it comes to naming an agent, is status quo. And I don't think that status quo is actually like a willful being that's actively harming women in some way. You know, we're just going to, so these vague forces, you know, status quo is the problem. Status quo is not the problem. I mean, it does create a status quo for sure. You know, we all, there's a sort of inertia of, you know, the hegemony that we all live under, but that's not the problem. The problem is that there's a class called men, and the things that they're doing is a class of people called women.
I wanted to read you this, this quote from Anne Hathaway from the website. She says, because Anne Hathaway is sort of, she's joined the movement, and they featured an interview with her in Glamour magazine about 1 Million Rising. And so she says in Glamour magazine, "When I think back to some of the most fun nights of my life, it was just me out dancing without a care in the world. It's a release, an outlet, and I'm a firm believer that we can tap into a collective energy and consciousness. On the 14th, even if you're in a field dancing by yourself, you're going to know you're not alone. That's something I hope we can carry forward as we resolve to protect ourselves and our sisters." And I think there's some good things to see in that statement for sure. Like, I think, you know, on one hand, we want to support people's enthusiasm about feminist activism, and this is obviously getting a lot of attention, and Eve Ensler is someone who's done some really, really great work in the feminist movement. And the idea of not being alone is something that's worthwhile in many ways. Like, as a woman living in a patriarchy, I think that it can be isolating, and we don't quite know how to respond. But you talked about earlier the idea of sort of meditating and spirituality, and in this case, dancing as a response to global atrocities or oppression. And so I wonder what you think are some larger implications of this kind of movement, the idea that meditation or positive thinking or collective dancing can affect change.
I want to read a quote from Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Bright Sided. This is a really important book, and I really encourage all feminists to read it. I think all of her work is wonderful, but I particularly love this one. She got breast cancer and was then exposed to this whole world of a kind of new age positive thinking ideas, and found them very offensive and patronizing, as well as very dangerous politically, because it segues very neatly into the demands of a capitalist economy. Mm-hmm. If something goes wrong in your life, it's not because, you're at the bottom of a pyramid scheme. You know, a certain number of people are always going to have to be poor for the rich to be rich. A certain number of people are always going to have to be unemployed. That's how capitalism works. There's always going to be unemployment. So if you lose your job, you know, it's a complete, shifting of your focus away from the structural reasons why you are poor, economically oppressed, why you're suffering, why you can't pay your rent. And instead, it's the focus on you had the wrong attitude. Mm-hmm. And if you just think positively, it'll all come around. Not if you act collectively and demand justice, but if you individually change your mind and talk yourself into this, it will all be fine. Because somehow we all have this magic power to affect material reality as individuals by thinking nice thoughts. So this is a quote from her book. She says, "I do not write this in a spirit of sourness or personal disappointment of any kind, nor do I have any romantic attachment to suffering as a source of insight or virtue. On the contrary, I would like to see more smiles, more laughter, more hugs, more happiness, and better yet, more joy. In my own vision of utopia, there is not only more comfort and security for everyone, better jobs, health care, and so forth. There are also more parties, festivities, and opportunities for dancing in the streets. Once our basic material needs are met, in my utopia anyway, life becomes a perpetual celebration in which everyone has a talent they contribute. But we cannot levitate ourselves into that blessed condition by wishing it. We need to brace ourselves for a struggle against terrifying obstacles. And the first step is to recover from the mass delusion that is positive thinking." Mm-hmm. So I agree with that. I've certainly had my run-ins with, you know, the same crowd of positive thinkers, both New Age and Christian, and it's very blame the victim, it's very individualist, and ultimately it's magical thinking that somehow, and they really like to do it number on quantum physics. It's almost like a human rights violation of quantum physics, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, their version of what physicists have found really bears no relation to what the actual physicists say about, you know, the sort of strata of material reality that we can't see with the naked eye. And it's very fascinating stuff, but it has nothing to do with the level of reality at which we all live, which is a Newtonian level, okay? I mean, we have bodies, they have mass, they respond to gravity. You know, the stuff that quarks do has nothing to do with, you know, how you and I are going to stand up and walk and not fall over and the physical forces that, you know, are always at play when you have a physical body. But, you know, they take what they want and they run with it, and it's, and they sort of have built this whole world where every individual is in charge of every single thing that happens to them. We create our own reality by thinking certain thoughts and not thinking other thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So if something bad happens to you, it's absolutely your fault, and, you know, you're supposed to embrace whatever hardships you have and think about it a different way, and then your fortunes will turn around because you've achieved some kind of spiritual state, or I don't even know what all. But anyway, it's very victim-blaming, and it's completely depoliticized. You know, there's never any sense that there's a reason people are poor and suffering, and it's called capitalism. You know, it's called patriarchy. So I think that it's kind of a dangerous place for people to go when we're trying to build a movement instead. I mean, in my version of that 1 Billion Rising, the little film, yes, you would see the atrocities for sure. We have to face the atrocities. And then, sort of meditating and the earth shaking and all of that, what we would see would be women actually rising up and taking action to change, you know, the political systems under which we suffer. So there would be a massive strike. There would be women doing civil disobedience. You know, every capital around the globe would be shutting down the government. We'd be confronting rapists and batterers. We'd be saving girls from sex slavery. There would be just all these confrontations with power, teaching girls to read, you know, redistributing food to women and girls. It could be stopping civil wars like the women did in Liberia. I mean, it's an incredible project that they undertook in Liberia, and they were phenomenally successful using only nonviolent techniques. They stopped the civil war. They had just had enough of men's violence. And there's a fabulous film you can watch, a documentary. It's called Pray the Devil Back to Hell, and it's how the women there did that. And it's really extraordinary, very inspiring. But that's what I would like to see in 1 Billion Rising. You know, there's a woman alone on a bus, and she's being harassed by, what do you know, a group of men, and a bunch of women come on and beat them up or push them off or teach them a lesson somehow. When we can discuss whether or not violence or nonviolence, that's a very appropriate discussion to always have. But regardless, you know, in my version of this, women are actually stopping these atrocities, demanding justice, running for office, fighting back, taking control of the economic system, you know, redistributing wealth, doing the things that we should be doing to create justice and liberty for women and girls. And there might be dancing, that's fine, but dancing alone is no kind of political strategy. And I want to be very clear, I am not encouraging women, you know, to boycott this event or not go to this event. I think if there's one in your neighborhood, one in your city, you should go, participate, do what you can. And a lot of the local events are in fact something way more radical than what's being proposed on this website. They actually are talking about patriarchy and male power and holding men accountable. And that has to be done. That's the second part of this. This is sort of like the first, you know, the first stage of it is what's been put up on the website. But I think locally, women aren't even really following what's on the website. I think they're doing what they know has to be done, which is to say they've got to name men. So I think if there's an event happening in your neighborhood, please go and try to bring the second half of what has to be named and what has to be done to the event. Make this as radical as it should be. Bring the political part of this back in. There's not an individual solution. How you feel inside is not going to change patriarchy. So, you know, we're only going to change patriarchy by changing patriarchy. So do go and bring the more radical analysis and bring political demands and, you know, bring your organizing skills and make something good happen where you live, would sort of be my plea of what we could do, you know, to make this event be what it should really be.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, why do you think these kinds of movements are so popular? Like I mentioned earlier, like this is getting a lot of press, and people everywhere, women everywhere, are really excited about participating, which is really great. And again, for a feminist kind of movement to be getting this kind of attention and for people to be getting excited about getting involved, that's a, you know, a significant thing, but it's a bit abnormal in some ways. And why do you think people are so drawn to this event in particular?
I think two reasons, and it's kind of the half empty, half full kind of dilemma. Part of the truth, but not the whole truth. So we can name the truth that women are suffering. We can't name the truth that, in fact, it's men who are responsible for this. And she's sort of drawn the line exactly in the right spot to be able to get enough media attention. So I think that's probably why. Another reason, sort of a deeper reason, is that there are many, many instances across history of people embracing these kind of millennialist spiritual solutions to incredible trauma and stress that you know has been inflicted upon them, and they always end in disaster. I mean, they either end in irrelevance or they end in just complete disaster. And the worst example that I know of from history is the Xhosa cattle killing cult. Now, the Xhosa are a cattle herding people in southern Africa. They endured 200 years of colonial occupation and oppression from the British and also the Dutch. 1854, I think, was the year. It is a terrible disease, a lung disease, that wipes out a whole bunch of their cattle. So they're enduring all this stress, trauma, you know, as a people. There's hunger. They're being pushed off their land. Their future is very uncertain. And now there's this terrible disease. In 1856, a teenage girl has a vision, and she's told that if everybody kills their cattle, if they just believe, they kill the cattle and destroy all the crops, that there will be an army of spirit warriors that come. They will push out the British. The dead will be restored. Everybody sick will be healed. These huge, gigantic cows will come, more milk than you've ever seen. Everything's going to be wonderful. And all you have to do is believe and kill the cattle. And so the leaders of the community tell everybody, kill the cattle. We have to do this. Cattle are slaughtered. The day comes, and, of course, none of this comes to pass. And there's a book that was written that was called When Prophecies Fail, about another prophecy in the 1950s that, you know, didn't go anywhere either. And it's in that book that they invent the phrase cognitive dissonance, because what happens when reality doesn't match what people wish it to be, and that experience is called cognitive dissonance. So on one hand, you've got, you know, the reality that you're so attached to, and on the other hand, what is actually happening. And when people are in that kind of cult-like mindset, and they're experiencing cognitive dissonance, what usually happens is they don't give up their belief. They believe it even more strongly. And the people that they turn on are the non-believers. Mm-hmm. So rather than say, okay, I fell for this and it's actually not going to go anywhere, it didn't work because some of you didn't believe it. So the very last cattle are then killed, because some people hung on to one. Like, you know, I got children to feed. I'm not killing my milk cow. Didn't matter. All of them now. Everything is slaughtered. There is nothing left. 400,000 head of cattle were killed in the cattle killing cult. And, of course, you know, at the end of the year, 40,000 people died of starvation. None of the prophecy, you know, none of it came true. Mm-hmm. And there's this very, very poignant quote from a historian who said, 200 years of colonial rule could not do to the Xhosa what 2 years of this millennialist fever did. Because they ended up having to approach the British, you know, half-starved supplicants just begging for mercy. Mm-hmm. So they were, you know, pretty well devastated. It took them quite a while. The Xhosa are still there. I don't mean to say that they were out of existence. I think actually Nelson Mandela, that's his people, are the Xhosa people. So there are still Xhosa around, but this was just a terrible blow. And it's completely understandable why people retreat under unbearable circumstances. This is a place where the human mind and the human spirit goes for relief. But I think that we need to be very cautious. We need to learn from history. Another example would be the Boxer Rebellion. They called themselves the Righteous Harmony Society. This was in China. Again, a response to colonial oppression under the British. And a very similar story of, you know, if we do these special things and we eat the special food and we believe these things, you know, and do the martial arts, they'll be the spirit warriors and the British will go away and all this will magically happen. And, of course, it ends in complete disaster. If you know your history, third example would be the ghost dance amongst the Plains Indians. Very similar. People under tremendous stress from genocide, colonial occupation, and they take up this millennialist belief, which again ends in just a complete massacre. And these are very, very grim examples from history. And this is one of the reasons why I'm willing to, I don't like criticizing what other feminists do in public. I mean, there's so few of us. We're up against so much. It's a really hard thing to stick your neck out and attempt something like what Eve Ensler is doing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I know we talked about this before the interview. We're both very hesitant to criticize what other women are doing, but I find this very dangerous. Having studied this, you know, across a few centuries of history, the times that people take this up as a political program, it does not end well. And we need to caution ourselves. I understand the kinds of despair and the trauma that most women live with, but this is not a solution. I think that there is a role for spiritual belief and spiritual community in political movements, and I like this phrase, culture of resistance. And I think there are lots of examples of the ways that a spiritual or even religious set of institutions and practices and community norms can be incredibly important for resistance movements. Sometimes they're really the cradle of the resistance. And we can talk about the black churches of the civil rights movement or the movement against apartheid in South Africa. And they're very, very central. So I'm not somebody who's anti-spiritual. I want to make that very clear. I'm not an atheist. I've had my own spiritual journey and my own kind of spiritual experiences, which, you know, that's a whole other discussion. But I don't come at this from somebody who's anti-spiritual. That is certainly a discussion worth having, you know, about what we believe or not. But that's not where I'm coming from with this. I think that there is a very appropriate role that spirituality can play in resistance movements. But this kind of millennialist belief that a mystical force is somehow going to come to our aid, it's not. Okay, it has never worked. Mm-hmm. Never. You know, in 10,000 years of patriarchy and these kinds of horrors, people have prayed and prayed and prayed, you know, when their lives were going down, and it's never worked. It's never happened. So I think that we need to give that up as a political plan. To really have a culture of resistance, it has to see itself as the cradle of an actual resistance movement. And the way that I think about this is the culture of resistance is like the fertile earth, and the resistance movement is the seed of a tree. And with it, each one without the other just ends in sterility and death. So if the ground is bare and there's no plants there, eventually it'll just become dust. It'll just turn into a desert. Whereas if you have that seed, which would be the political movement, but it's not planted in that fertile ground, then it never grows. So each one needs the other. You need that fertile earth. You need that space and the ideas and the experience of being in the culture of resistance. And then out of that comes, you know, that mighty oak that will be the resistance movement. And you can see that pattern throughout history. And it's been really interesting to me to study some of this, because I found the same pattern so often. The Gaelic Revival was the movement in Ireland where they were very, very self-conscious about this. That's what I love about it. They were so clear. We need to get, you know, liberation from this English occupation. It's been going on 800 years. It's absolutely unbearable. Our people are starving. What are we going to do? And they understood the first thing we have to do is decolonize our minds. We've got to reclaim what it means to be Irish. We have to take pride in being Irish. We have to redefine what it means. You know, we're not just this subjugated people. We actually have a culture of our own. So they revived the traditional arts, the dance, the music, the theater festivals. So there's this explosion of this, all this sort of Celtic stuff. And then 20 years later, you actually get the political resistance movement, which, of course, is bubbling along beside it. But suddenly you've got the land war, which is this incredible movement that was waged almost entirely nonviolently to get the land back into the hands of small farmers in Ireland, and it was dramatically successful. And from there, they go on to fight the actual war for independence. So, but they knew that they needed that first, that they had to have that culture of resistance first. And that's because oppressed people survive psychologically under oppression using three main tactics, and it's accommodation, denial, and consent. And we have to break through that as radicals. Mm-hmm. No matter, you know, what liberation struggle you're fighting, that's what you're up against. And it's always going to be those three things. And the culture of resistance helps people do that. Mm-hmm. It breaks through their identification with the oppressor, and they learn to have self-respect as a people, and learn to have solidarity with each other, and learn a whole new set of values and community norms. And that's crucial to then go on and fight the resistance movement. And you see the same pattern in the Baltics, which, you know, had been conquered by Russia, so Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. There's a movement called the Great Awakening in the late 19th century, and, you know, it takes about 100 years, but eventually they do get to freedom from the Soviet Union. And it follows the exact same pattern, where there's singing and there's dancing and there's all this folk culture going on, the poetry, all of this. But embedded in the center of it is, all of this is so that we can fight a resistance movement. It's never separated. If it's going to be successful, you have to have both. Another example would be the civil rights movement in the United States and the Harlem Renaissance. So you've got, again, this just outpouring of poetry and music and jazz music, you know, the blues, all this stuff, you know, sort of comes together, especially in Black Harlem there and New York City and in other places, you know, other urban centers. And it's the same idea. It's a redefinition of what it means to be black. And, you know, all that, the self-respect, the, you know, community norms about solidarity. And from there, next generation, you go right into the civil rights movement. So it's the same pattern everywhere you look. And my point here is that central to this often is some kind of spiritual practice. And often things like dance and music are also absolutely central to the culture of resistance. So I'm not saying these things are bad or that they're not useful. All I'm saying is that they're not actually political resistance.
Mm-hmm.
They are necessary but not sufficient. So for it to actually be a culture of resistance, you have to believe in resistance. You have to encourage it. You have to plan for it. You have to support it. And you have to prepare for its success. So you have to see it as the cradle of that resistance. So this event I see is more perhaps the culture of resistance part of it, but as long as it's unhooked from actual confrontations with power, you know, it's just kind of dead end into that irrelevance, you know, that metaphor of the desert or the dust that the ground turns into without the tree. We need both. So whatever your calling is, if, you know, your calling is to make inspirational music or to make paintings or poetry or any of that stuff, we need it. We really need it all. We need those kind of art forms that will inspire women to stand up, you know, to take our place and to demand justice. And I mean, we all have our go-to song when life is really bad. We all have the songs. It's like, okay, this will make me feel better today. I'll be able to go on with the fight. If we all have those. We need those kinds of songs. We do. We need the art. You know, we need all of it. But we also need to actually be confronting male power and the material conditions to create justice and liberty for girls and women around the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your perspective. It's been super valuable, and thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for everything you're doing. I love your radio show, and I'm really glad that you're out there doing your work.
You just heard an interview with Lierre Keith. For more on her work, visit lierrekeith.com. That's Lierre Keith.com. And for more on 1 Billion Rising, which is taking place on February 14th, 2013, visit 1billionrising.org. I'm Megan Murphy, and that is all the time we have for today. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.